John chapter 11, verse 1. Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Verse 4, when he says, When Jesus heard, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. That reminds me of when he spoke of the man who was born blind. They asked him, saying, for whose sin was this man born blind? Was it for his own or for his parents? And Jesus said, for neither, but that the works of God may be made manifest in him. So he gives them the assurance that Lazarus is not to die. But that is not the purpose of this sickness. But this sickness has another purpose, which is to glorify God, and that the Son of God might be glorified by it, this sickness. And he loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Verse 6 says, When he had heard therefore that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. He did not immediately come, which would of course seem unusual because of the fact he loved them. There's no question as to his desire to heal them. I mean, you see many times in the Gospels where Jesus is called and he goes immediately and he heals someone. Or I think of the one time when the soldier came to him and said, I am a man under authority. I understand authority. If you have any authority, you can just command my daughter recover, or my servant, I forgot which one it was. It doesn't matter. You can command from afar that the sickness depart, and it will be done. And so he was able to heal at a distance. So this is very intentional, of course. He wants Lazarus to die. And I see a lot of spiritual application there, because sometimes for the people he loves most, the hardest trials can possibly come upon us. We want to be close to God, but do we really understand what that takes? Like as Jesus asked his disciples when he was going to be crucified, can you be baptized with the baptism which I will be baptized with? Can you drink of the cup from which I will drink? And they're like, oh yeah. He's like, well, you will. But it was not to be at that time. But I tell you right now, you're all gonna abandon me and forsake me. Paraphrase there. So he did not go immediately, he dilly-dallied intentionally. And verse 7 says, Then after that saith he to his disciples, Let us go into Judea again. His disciples say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If a man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. These things said he, and after that he said unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. Howbeit Jesus spake of his death. But they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. And verse 16, Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him. And he has to head back into Judea to heal Lazarus. He could have done it at a distance. But his disciples see it as this sort of life-risking thing, because they had wanted to kill him lately. And therefore, maybe his dilly-dallying seemed very natural to them, like that he didn't just go right up to Judea. Seemed like it made sense. They didn't say, hey, don't you care about your friends? Don't you care about the people you love? Don't you want to heal them? Don't you want to go there and run to them? And you know, the same thing could be said. We sometimes get into trouble in our lives, and you think, you know, why doesn't God run to our assistance? Why does he not just simply wave his hand and magically make everything good when we want it? You know, and this comes very easily to me because I've experienced this in life, that, you know, afterwards, you know, and the fruit that is born through difficult times, you see that it was good that he was not there. Just as he said, I'm glad for your sake that I wasn't there. You know, there's sometimes when God is glad to leave us, so to speak, in the tomb. To leave us in a perilous position. And because, you know, Lazarus is dead, as Jesus says. That is the greatest peril of all. And I'm going to just sort of go out of order. There's some things I want to cover here, but it doesn't matter which order we go in. Lazarus is dead. And, you know, this is always the way death is spoken of in the scriptures. And then say, well, Lazarus is actually with God. You know, because most people believe that when you die, you instantly go to the presence of God. So Lazarus is in Abraham's bosom. Where else would Lazarus be? I mean, that's what it says in the parable of Lazarus. It's a common name, though, you should know. It's a contraction of Eleazar, which was one of the I believe the grandson of Moses, or of Aaron. Actually, Aaron, I think. Yeah, Aaron. You could say, oh, it just refers to his body. But there is supposed to be a certain finality in death, and what it truly is, what it truly means to be dead. Just as things that are without life in this world are dead, you know, like rocks and things, you know, wood that has been made into furniture. You know, there's no life in it. And it's not just that the body is dead, it's just the man is dead. But there is, through a promise of resurrection, that man, that is the only way in which man can be said to still be alive. And to live again. And that's how Jesus taught it. And so Jesus in verse 9 says, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. And now this was in response to them saying, you know, they wanted to kill you and you go back. Basically, that he is walking in the light and he does not stumble. Every action he takes is intentional and in accordance with God's desires and plans. And every man who is in the Son of God also walks in the light and does not stumble in the ultimate sense. That everything that is happening according to intention. But of course, when you walk in darkness, you cannot do everything according to intention, because there are things hidden in there and you do not see the way you go. And that is how his enemies are. They're groping in darkness. They do not know where they are going. You know, and they do things that they do not intend to do. Yeah, I was recently teaching in Acts chapter 4, where it says, you know, the leaders take counsel together, quoting from Psalm 2. And they want to destroy the work of God, or, you know, whatever work it is they, you know, they don't think it's the work of God, but whatever work of God is being done that they misidentify, they mark it out for destruction. And God sees it as an action against himself. And whatever it is they think they're doing, it doesn't matter, because whatever they do, God's hand has already ordained that they should do it. They take counsel and then they do what God had intended that they should do. And if they hadn't really known, had the wisdom to know what was really going on, they might have chosen differently. But because they walk in darkness, they choose the things that they do not intend. But in all things, God is getting his way. You know, and ultimately, think about it, the light shows us whatever God wants us to see is what we see. And we walk by what he leads us in. And that is how we walk. An obstacle appears in our path. And don't read too much into the idea of an obstacle. But we go around. That's God guiding us. When the wicked walk in darkness, an obstacle appears in their path, and they stumble over it. You know, when we have him, we are guided in the lights, and we will not stumble. But those without him are walking in darkness, and they do stumble. So his enemies will not get their way. Even when they think they're getting their way, they're not. And everything Christ does is intentional and according to the purpose of God. And that relates to this. And after that, he says, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him out of sleep. Notice the analogy that when Lazarus is dead, he is said to be asleep. And, you know, the idea of when you're asleep, you're unconscious. Yeah, I know there's dreams and stuff, but dreams are not quite the same as consciousness. And it really doesn't need to come into the analogy. No analogy is perfect. You can't just apply every, well, if it's like sleep, then what about dreaming? Maybe you're in heaven. Well, in fact, that's why I think a lot of near-death experiences are just dreams of people who are not really dead. As I've often said, if you want to say that near-death experiences are real, then you have to yield to doctors the ability to raise the dead. And they don't claim to raise the dead. Because no one who's ever had a near-death experience was ever really dead. They may be clinically or biologically or whatever terminology they want to put. They're dead. You know, their life functions have stopped. But not long enough for medicine to be, you know, to prevent medicine from being able to resuscitate them, obviously. You know, you give someone no heartbeat and at room temperature for so long, and give them a day or so, you can't bring them back. No one has ever come back from that by medical means. And so the dead don't really, according to the scriptures, the dead know not anything. So death, when he speaks of death as sleep, he means in the sense that it's unconscious. Lazarus is sleeping. We're going to wake him. You know, just like when Christ died, when he rose from the dead, he told Mary, Mary, he said, touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. And as the scriptures declare in Acts chapter 3, his soul was not left in hell. You know, he was placed in the grave. He remained in the grave for 3 days. His person was buried and dead and returned to life. And so, he had power to lay his life down and power to take it again. Jesus here is speaking, of course, of Lazarus' death when he spoke of sleep. This is an illustration that Christ uses, that Paul uses. The death is likened to sleep. Whereas the modern sort of idea of death is nothing like sleep. It only appears to sleep to people who are still alive, sort of. And that sort of makes you question, well, what is the meaning of the analogy? I mean, because you could have the analogy where, like, when someone's dead, they look like they're sleeping. And you could say, well, the analogy is from the perspective of someone who's looking at a corpse. Well, they kind of look like they're sleeping. It's kind of a euphemism. You know, it means a nice way of saying someone's dead. They sleep. But it could also, it can refer to that, but it could also have reference to their state of mind. And that's why when it says we will wake him, you know, it's reasonable to think of that as being in reference to either Lazarus's perspective or the perspective of those who look on him. But in general, as I've always made it clear, you know, death, I certainly believe that death, and the majority of scriptures lead me to believe that death is the cessation of consciousness. I didn't always believe this. But I think that taking all the scriptures into account, and not just the ones that we favor, you come to this conclusion. And that, you know, like I said, this is a position I switched to after years of being in the Bible. I definitely think I used to prefer it, the other view. But when I adopted this view, I realized that it fit into a much more solid understanding of how things work. And I find it much easier to explain scriptures that seem to contradict this idea than the ones that contradict the other idea. The problem is, though, the scriptures that are upholding the opposing view are very famous, popular, well-known. Everyone likes to quote them. But you have to, when you're immersed in the scriptures for so long a time, there are scriptures you run across over and over, and you start to think. Makes you question. So he says, Lazarus is dead. Let me make that clear. He's dead. The thing is, Jews had many opportunities to explain what it was like to be dead. And in any scripture where they're trying to explain what death is like, you know, Lazarus and the rich man, that's not a scripture that's about what it's like to be dead. That's a scripture about the law and what men believe in. They have Moses and the prophets, they don't believe them. And though one rose from the dead, Christ, they didn't believe him. The things they do believe, though, are traditions of men, like Abraham's bosom and so on and so forth. And, you know, if you listen to my Luke study, you can pick up on that and read also my document on death and the resurrection of the dead, which I recommend. Verse 17. Then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. Now Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask God, God will give it thee. Jesus saith unto her, Thy brother shall rise again. Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? She said unto him, Yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, The Master is come, and calleth for thee. And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now, let's hold on right there. Yeah, there are a lot of people who have come, and Martha comes out to greet him. I like this conversation they have. Her faith is very strong here. Whatever you will ask of God, God will give it to you. Your brother shall rise again. And she responds with her faith in the resurrection. My former teacher of years ago, Arnold Murray, I remember he used to really sort of, the next statement of Jesus, he would set it at, and I don't know how, the reason I mention him is because I don't have other Bible teachers to compare. I haven't listened to a lot of other teachers. But they, or he, really set this up as Jesus almost rebuking her. I am the resurrection and the life. You know, like sort of like, I remember him sort of reading it almost like mocking her, like she's got the wrong idea. Even though back in chapters 5 and 6, Jesus was saying the same thing. I will raise him up on the last day. I will raise him up on the last day. She's expressing faith in his words. I know that he shall rise again. That's what she thought he was speaking of. But she said, even ahead of that, I know whatever you ask of God, God will give it to you. She already knows that Jesus can raise him from the dead. And when he says he shall rise again, she says, I know he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. That is an affirmation of the things Christ has already taught in John. That I will raise him up at the last day. That phraseology is his own. They had listened to him. They believed in his teaching of the resurrection. And when he says this, this is not any sort of rebuke. He's just making a statement. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Now, again, all men die. So what does that mean? Never die. We never die. And some people might say, well, that means when you die, your consciousness continues and you make a transition from one plane of existence to another. Well, it's never taught in the scriptures like that. You know, except for if you take Lazarus and the rich man for what it is, but that's what the Lazarus and the rich man is the traditions of the Jews, not the teachings of the law and Moses, and not the teachings of Christ or his apostles. It would be a sort of a new taken from some other traditions. Anyways, that's not what he's referring to. Never means never die. It's literally one word in English, never, is covered by, let me tell you how many Greek words, a total of 5. Au me eis ton aiona. Au me is a strengthened form of no. That means like, au me is like by no means. Eis ton aiona means unto the age. Now that's often used as ever, and translated even eternal in some passages. Iona means of an ion or an age, you know, like we have eons and eons in English. And that's sort of what it means, is like, he will never die means by no means throughout all the ages he shall not die. What it means is he will live forever. But it doesn't mean he will never experience physical death. Or experience what death, the unconsciousness of death, even. Because, I mean, we all experience unconsciousness. And certainly, it is what death is. It is a no thought. And so, whoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Now, this also gets off to the other people, the people who do not inherit eternal life. They do die. That's why it's called the second death. And it is like the first death, unconsciousness and everlasting darkness. So he says, do you believe this? That whoever believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Whoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Yes, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And that is why Lazarus is raised. To prove to people by this notable miracle that he is the Son of God, which had come into the world. And so she called Mary over there, and saying, the Master has come and called for you, and she goes out to him. Verse 30, now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house, and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she arose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goeth unto the grave to weep there. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hast been here, my brother had not died. That's the same thing where Martha opens up with that. I believe, does she not? Yes, if you had been here, my brother had not died, but I know. Whatever you can do. I don't know that Mary didn't know that as well. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, where have you laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. And some of them said, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? Jesus therefore again, groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone." I think that sometimes the emotion of the Lord here can be misread. And it's quite clear in the context. Jesus intentionally delayed. He knows he's about to raise Lazarus. Why does he weep? Why does he weep? Why does he groan? What does this word groan even mean? According to the sources I have, it means to snort as a horse does from fear or anger. So it means to feel strong emotion and can indicate indignation. So he had some strong feelings. She's weeping. The Jews are weeping. Everyone's weeping their brains out over this. Now, but they all affirm that they have hope in the resurrection. But the thing is, it's natural, though, when human beings lose someone, to mourn that loss, because Jesus isn't always here to raise people from the dead, and they go, and then you have to spend the rest of your life without them. And over history, everyone has died. Everyone has died and been buried, or disposed of in one way or the other. But their bodies decay and they go away, and they are not among us anymore. It's very natural to be very sad about that. We spend our whole lives avoiding death, and we try. We don't want our loved ones to die. We don't want to lose people. And everyone here is mourning and weeping. Many of them believe on him. Mary and Martha do. They know. But I think that it's in some way that they had so little faith in him. That they had so little faith in him that they would be so overwrought about this death. Did he come just to see a funeral? Did he come just to, just to pay his respects? What did they think he came for? And wept here, it means to shed tears. It is the noun dakru, and dakra means tears. It's always translated the plural tears. It means his eyes teared. He was feeling not the emotion of sorrow necessarily. And I'm not saying Jesus didn't feel sorrow or couldn't feel sorrow.
I mean, Christ was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief.
I just don't see that here. I don't see him any sorrow. In fact, the comment in the next verse, when the Jews say, "Behold how he loved him." Remember, these are the people that Jesus said are walking in darkness. They don't see what's really going on. He's going here to shed light on the situation. And they are all weeping and stumbling about in the darkness. His tears, I see it as like angry tears. Just the context, that's just how it feels. His eyes were watering. And they thought it was, naturally they thought it was sorrow. But I don't think that was behind them. That's what this groaning in his spirit, and he was troubled. He troubled himself. In what way? I look back in other times when God's spirit is troubled, and it's like Genesis 6. The man's ways were very wicked, and the Lord was troubled about it. And here their lack of faith is troubling. Their sorrow. We do, as Paul says, we do not sorrow as those who have no hope. In the old days, and in these days also, a lot of times there are professional weepers who would come and wail at funerals. And I think they still have this in some cultures. They like wail, they throw themselves in the coffins, they just really put on a big emotional display. And I think it's very sad when someone dies, but we do not sorrow as others who have no hope. We do not sorrow as those who have no hope. We know that the dead will rise again. And this is being affirmed all around. And yet, all this sorrow, all these weeping and moaning, and Christ's groaning here in his troubling is not for sorrow. Not for the dead. He's about to raise him. He knows this. It's not like, oh, Lazarus is lost. I mean, I could see him. I could totally believe in him empathizing with humanity as far as our... And I see it as a complex emotional thing. I mean, you don't want to one-dimensionalize Christ. You know, I mean, because he can empathize with the feelings of man's loss. But at the same time, here he is. He's come to raise the dead. But he comes in a situation where there's no faith. Everyone is just weeping like he's gone forever. And they were saying, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? Verse 38, Jesus therefore again groaning in himself cometh to the grave. It was a cave, a stone lay on it. I already read this. Verse 39, Jesus said, take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days, in case you didn't hear. And Jesus said unto her, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? So now, you know, she had shown faith at first, but then this, you know, they got caught up in all the emotion of the situation, and he is saying, didn't I tell you? You know, they affirmed all these. That's the thing that I think they most probably hurt him, is that in a sense, they had affirmed, or Martha had affirmed all this. But then he comes to the scene, and people believed the miracles he had done before, but they didn't believe in him. I don't necessarily see them also jumping and rejoicing just because he's there. But like I said, the weeping and the throwing, the way they used to weep was very demonstrative. And so, verse 41, then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when he had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Napkin probably a band, you know, sudarion. It's a sweat cloth used for the head. There's actually a, if you've done research on the Shroud of Turin, there's a sudarion. It's called the sudarion, or sudarium. Sudarium. It's a Latin word, actually. The Sudarium of Oviedo, which has blood stains on it, which match the blood stains on the Shroud of Turin, and it also has a history going back to the 7th century, or even farther. I think it was at least 7th century when it came to Spain. So, and it's it's traditionally believed to be the face cloth of Christ. And the blood stains on it match the blood stains on the Shroud. So, it's very interesting. But anyways, Lazarus also had, and the way they bound the bodies up, they wrapped it in linen cloth, and then they would bind the hands and the feet to keep them in place, and also have his face bound up with this, with the sudarium. And so he comes forth, but he's bound. Now, I don't understand. How is he? Is he hopping? Levitating? I don't know. It doesn't say. He comes out, but he's bound. I mean, you could probably shuffle out. It'd be kind of weird. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily... It could have been kind of interesting if he had sort of like floated out, but then maybe that's a little too much. He'd probably just sat up on the edge of his thing. He's tied up and not able to loose himself, so he kind of shuffles out. I could imagine him shuffling. I mean, he wasn't bound that tight. And Jesus said, loose him and let him go. I think Christ's prayer here is very, you know, it indicates his state of mind. You know, and also when he replies to Mary, I mean, it indicates his state of mind. Does he sound like he's in a weeping mood? I thank you that you have heard me. I knew you hear me always, but because of everyone standing by, I said this because that they may believe. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary... I mean, it's interesting that he says that because he's praying for the sake of people around him. And sometimes we do pray like that. You know, yes, enter into your closet, right? But there are times when you pray so that other people around can hear. And that's for their hearing. As long as, you know, for Christ, though, it was imperative that he must have a testimony of himself that he was the Son of God. So that those who reject him could be guilty, and that those who believed in him might inherit eternal life. Verse 45, then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen these things which Jesus did believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. So it's interesting. Some people believe on him, and then others go and tell. You know, I suppose you can see... I mean, here's the thing. I know that in the end times, the Antichrist is going to come working miracles. And it's going to be basically the exact opposite of Jesus. I mean, whereby at that time, he came working miracles, and what you're supposed to do is believe in him. When the Antichrist comes, he's going to come working miracles. What you're supposed to do is not believe in him. I mean, it's a bizarre turnaround. That's why Jesus says you can discern the face of the sky, but you do not understand the signs of the times. You don't know the time you're living in. They saw the miracles and thought bad. You know, the bad guys saw the miracles, they thought bad. In the end times, it's going to be the exact opposite. The bad guys are going to see the miracles and think good. And the good guys are going to see the miracles and think bad, so to speak. I mean, good guys, bad guys, whatever. God's elect are going to be rejecting a miracle-working, claiming to be God, Messiah. I mean, that's what the Antichrist is going to claim to be God. Exalt himself above everything that is called God and put himself in the temple of God, making a show that he is God, working miracles, making fire come down from heaven, and who knows what else. Don't describe everything he'll be able to do. But, you know, everyone's looking for miracles. Oh, we wouldn't do what we would. If we were in the days of Jesus, we wouldn't reject him. No, we would follow him for sure, especially seeing all those miracles. Yeah, now in this end time, when the false Messiah comes performing miracles, people are going to think, well, that's what you do. When a guy comes performing miracles, claiming to be from God, you believe what he says and you follow him. And I guess that's why, you know, only the wise are going to really understand. Because for most people, that's kind of counterintuitive. But in the days of Jesus, there were plenty of people who had no problem rejecting Christ in spite of the miracles. This is devilish. Why? Because he did not obey the law. And so it'll be very easy for people to be turned against God's elect in the end times when the Antichrist does miracles and we reject him. You know, we'll look like a bunch of Pharisees. In the sense, because we have some predetermined idea of what's got to be, or what the scripture says, and we're not conforming to, you know, what God's doing, etc. The Pharisees, verse 47, then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council, and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many miracles." When someone does miracles, you got to have a council and figure out what to do. We got to do something about this. This man's doing many miracles. This is unprecedented, and we're losing control. We've got to do something. And here's the thing. Here's what they're really afraid of. Verse 48, if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. That's what they're really afraid of. No matter how many miracles he does, they fear the power of the Romans, more than they believe in the power of God to save their nation. I mean, and this is the problem with the Jews from the time of
ancient times, you man. I mean, in Isaiah, Jeremiah, all the prophets speak of this problem they have. Always looking to foreign powers, being more afraid of the Assyrian than they are of God. They're not afraid to break the law and to do abominations and to worship other gods, but they are afraid of the enemy. They are afraid of them that oppress them. And, you know, this is not just especially the Jews. All men are like this, but the Jews have a special history. So, they're the ones who we read about in the Bible. So, but this is true of their whole history. They were afraid of outside forces coming in and taking away their place and nation. You know, the temple is their source, their central source of their power and influence. You know, and all that system. Verse 49, and one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, ye know nothing at all, nor considerest that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this spake he not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. Then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. So Caiaphas is saying, for one man to die for the nation, because Christ laid down his life for many as a sacrifice for sins, that through faith in him we might become the sons of God. I mean, this is the core of the gospel, is the cross, and him laying his life down. And Caiaphas, of course, means we should murder this guy so that the nation won't be destroyed by the Romans, of course. But that's one way of interpreting his words. But a lot of times, you know, like Jesus said, you know, you walk in the light and you are walking deliberately. You do not stumble because you can see obstacles. You can walk around them. But if you don't see properly, if you're in the darkness, if you do not have the Son of God, if you do not believe on him and his light is not guiding you, you are in darkness, and though you may do God's will, it may not be your intention. You know, you go walk around, stumble. God wanted you to stumble. That's why he put you in darkness. And therefore, God's will is done, but they don't know what they do. That's why Jesus even said, forgive them, they do not know what they're doing. They thought they knew what they were doing. No, that's why their sin remains. So, as high priest, he was prophesying, not according to his intention, of course, but so they took counsel together to put him to death. Now, wait a second, weren't they trying to put him to death sooner? Yeah, but that was sort of like just a momentary thing. The Jews of late have sought to kill you. I mean, it was not an organized effort. It was just sort of, you know, at that moment they thought, let's stone this dude because of their rage. But then they cooled down. They figured, well, an eccentric minor preacher, he's afraid, he ran off, he's not bothering us, you know, things are quiet, you know, they figure, and they're not even technically supposed to put people to death for capital offenses, even, that was the Roman prerogative, and that's why they eventually will try to use the Romans to destroy him, because they, as they say, you know, it isn't, they aren't allowed to put men to death. And so, verse 54, Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country nearer to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand. In my mind, this is where chapter 12 should begin. But whatever, we'll include these verses. There's not going to be a lot to say. The Jews' Passover was nigh at hand. And many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They then sought they for Jesus and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple. What think ye, that he will not come to the feast? You know, do you think he's not going to come? Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he was, he should show it, that they might take him. And it goes into chapter 12. Like I said, these verses sort of lead into the next chapter. There's not a lot to say about them. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. So we'll pick it up next time with chapter 12.